I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. My chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspired their creations, what decisions changed their careers, what relationships influenced their work.
We had so much laughter in our house, you know, despite any dysfunction as any family, we always laugh.
I also feel like you want someone who you can be not great around, meaning I want to be able to be kind of boring sometimes or say something dumb and it's okay.
My guests today are two brilliant comedians, one an actor, the other a writer. Both have made millions of people laugh, and both have done so from the show that has launched more comedians than any other.
It's Saturday Night Live!
Writer Paul Appel and actor Fred Armisen took unusual paths to SNL. When Pell got the call that executive producer Lorne Michaels wanted to meet her, she'd been working at an amusement park in Florida, one with uniquely nighttime amusements.
Pleasure Island.
Welcome.
Come, Mickey has no pants on.
Before Armisen was added to SNL's cast in 2002, he had spent over a decade behind a drum set professionally. Eventually, SNL hired Armisen, my first guest this hour, to play something else.
On my first day in office, I said I'd close Guantanamo Bay.
Armisen has added to the show's distinctive line of oddly perfect presidential impressions. He's also nailed such disparate characters as Larry King, Steve Jobs, and Prince.
Attention, sexy passengers. This groove jet's about to take off, so please direct your attention to my co-host, Miss Beyoncé Knowles.
Fred Armisen grew up in Valley Stream, Long Island, with a Venezuelan mother and a German-Japanese father.
My mom really loved Saturday Night Live.
She did.
She loved it. I remember her talking about Chevy Chase, and she would say, like, oh, Chevy Chase, he's so funny. You just look at his face and you want to laugh. And that made a huge impression on me. And even as a kid, I thought, yeah, what is that? Like, a guy who, just from looking at him right away, you know, it was
He does
was
nothing and you
true.
Burst out laughing.
Yeah.
Armisen is also co-creator of Portlandia, a playfully subversive sketch comedy show on IFC in which he co-stars with musician Kerry Brownstein.
I did read that. Did you hear the thing at McSweeney's?
Mm.
I was comparing CD tracks and album tracks. Did you read that?
Yeah. Did you read that thing in Mother Jones about eco chairs and eco ways to sit?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Did you read that thing in Spain about all the festivals?
Did you read
Armisen's
that thing
own about the musical festival? Roots run deep. He spent most of his 20s touring with his punk rock band, Trenchmouth.
I worked so hard on that band. We were in the van, we toured.
Booking places, bars, clubs. And just trying to get slots in clubs.
Yeah.
Over what area?
The whole United States and Canada.
And you were offloading and reloading your own equipment.
Yeah.
You were your own roadies.
Absolutely. We didn't bring any extra people to save money. Up and down stairs, drums, cymbals, amps. If it was a local show, flyers, records, getting them out to people, getting them out to radio stations. It was nonstop.
Was it successful?
It depends how you look at
That's
it.
That's what I'm saying. I want to know your definition.
My definition, played in Europe, played in the States. So absolutely, all that stuff was like, that's a success. Was it what I wanted? I wanted much more.
You did?
Much more.
Why?
This is going to sound... I'll just be honest about what I wanted, but I wanted to be as big as the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I was like, God, they're huge.
Yeah.
They're huge. We can do it. So because we never attained that, and I would see bands from Chicago kind of swoop right by us, I saw it as not a success. And that's what kind of got me into doing comedy.
In 1998, Armisen went to Austin, Texas for the South by Southwest Music Festival. Along with his drums, he brought a video camera.
Somehow, I got it in my head to interview people, do different characters.
You're down there, and the whole experience down there was a musical one, but
yeah.
You start doing funny stuff.
And I don't even know why I did it. That tape, this is 1998, sort of made the rounds. They wrote about it in this local Chicago paper, and then I showed it at a club there that I used to play in Trenchmouth at this club. As many people turned out for that as with the band. The reaction was greater than when I was in a band. on that night, I thought, oh, this might be a way to go.
I'm here with the Aluminum Group. I just wanted to know from you guys, who thought up the name of the band? And I don't mean like originally. I mean like, who was the person who decided that that was going to be the name? And what record label are you on? Is it the same record label that you were on a couple years ago? Or is it one that's going to be different? And is it the one that's going to be on in Europe?
Did everybody in Trench Mouth get really sad then? Did they know you were going to go?
Maybe. But they're my friends, so I think they kept on going with another band.
I called all of them, and they said they hate you, and they'll never forgive
you. Oh, damn it.
No.
But hatred equals love.
Yeah, it's the flip
side. It's still an emotion.
It's still a warm emotion.
They're not ignoring me.
No. And then what happens after that?
That's when I started doing comedy, and then...
doing comedy where?
I started traveling the country, showing it in L.A., San Francisco, New York.
So you made it into a stand-up act?
Kind of. I would just, they'd write something in the paper and people came out in all these cities. And then I went to L.A.
You played
and did
clubs?
It. Yeah.
Comedy clubs?
Rock clubs.
Rock clubs.
Yeah.
Where there was no music?
No music. Just showed this video and talked a little bit and that's it.
And how long were you on stage?
I mean, total of like half an hour, 40 minutes
really?
Or something. Really short. Just wow. a little
people
event.
Dug it?
Absolutely. It's pre-internet. So showing a video was more of an event.
More nouvelle.
Yeah. There was no such thing as like sort of, why don't you just watch it online?
Right.
And then someone from HBO was at one of the shows, and then I started doing these videos for HBO. And then I started making enough money that I didn't have to live in Chicago anymore. I was like, I always wanted to live in L.A. I moved to L.A., and then I started doing stand-up like characters and stuff on stage.
Where?
There's this one club that I loved called Largo. I moved to L.A. and I just wanted to fit in. I was on my own and I just wanted to perform there and I would just do different characters.
Were all your friends back in Chicago?
Yeah.
Did you make all new friends right away? Did you fall into the comedy world?
Yeah, I did. I just wanted to be part of it. You know what I mean? So I think it was...
And you were open to it?
Yeah. And then I just...
And who became your pals there in L.A.?
Paul F. Tompkins. Bob Odenkirk really helped me out a lot. He had a pilot for a show called Next, which had different characters and it was a sort of variety show. And... he got me onto the cast for that. And from that is where I had, like, all the tape to submit to SNL.
Hello, welcome to Focus on Talent. I am Gerhard Lipschitz, and today my very special guest is the wonderfully simple Ray Romano. Thank you so much for coming. This is really great. And you began in stand-up comedy, and I think that your act was not so good, yes?
I had enough tape to submit to SNL. My agent and manager sent it to them, and then I was on the cast in 2002.
So you show up to New York to do the show.
I flew in to do the auditions. I was flipping out that I even got to do the auditions at all.
That's a big thing.
Yeah, I mean, I met Tina Fey for the first time, Lorne, and...
Tina was the head writer then?
I believe so. I think her and Dennis McNicholas. I couldn't even believe I was in that studio.
And then when you started, you were a featured player.
Yeah.
And then how many years did you do that before you joined
the
cast?
That was like 2 years. It was Will Forte and I.
And was it frustrating to be a featured player? Because again—
No.
It wasn't.
I'm fresh from carrying drums. I'm fresh from just doing stand-up at Largo.
So this is heaven.
There's a part of me that still is like, I can't believe it.
A lot of people on the show don't sense that. They leave and they don't realize how good they've had it, but it's a good show.
People who have left the show have told me, and I listen to them. And they say, it's the best job I ever had.
Yeah. It's going to be one of them. You're not going to have that much freedom and that much variety. I always tell people, don't leave the show and become the thing you made fun of on the show.
Right.
That's a real trap.
Yeah.
Because you're going to go out there and do other jobs. And one of the greatest risks in my mind is that people will characterize you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I can see you doing a movie where you're with a really smart cast and a smart director and you, like— lock everybody in the gymnasium and burn the gymnasium down to the ground. You could go either way, don't you think?
I hope so.
Do you want to do straight acting?
That's tricky.
Why?
If there's a way to do it, it's tricky because I don't want to look like I'm unhappy with comedy. Right. I don't want to go out there and say, for lack of a better word, an audience like, hey, this is what I really do. However, I think these days there are roles that are both comedic and dramatic.
Right.
I like that line is becoming blurry. So my answer is kind of like, I think there's a way that Peter Sellers did it, where it was right. It comedy or is it not comedy? Somewhere in
but
there.
But he occupies a very, very distinct place. I mean, yeah. You have comic actors who've made their reputation in comedic roles,
right?
Who've tried to go over into dramatic films and it's worked to some degree or hasn't worked, you know, Billy Crystal and Robin Williams and so forth.
Right.
And I think you have a real opportunity, and it's never more vivid than it is in Portlandia, that you could go both ways and do the comic and the dramatic. Do you feel that way?
Yes, because when we do the show, when we write the show, we don't always think about, like, what's the funniest thing?
Right.
Like, what seems interesting to us? What's going to look
nice? And if
nice?
The funny comes, it comes.
Great. If it's not quite comedy, that's okay. Like, that's it's something else in between. TV.
If there's anything that you've done, then we won't do it.
Okay, I get it. This is like a cool wedding.
But also, doesn't come across as cool. We don't want anything that reads as wedding.
Okay.
We're not marionettes getting up at the same time and dancing to and fro.
There's a 60% divorce rate, and I think that should be in the forefront of people's minds at this wedding.
The Got other it. Voice that's you're hearing, that's Carrie Brownstein. She co-created Portlandia with Armisen. Before Portlandia, they made a series of videos as the sketch comedy duo Thunder Ant. Carrie met Fred in 2003, late one night after an SNL show.
Her band was like my favorite band, this band Sleater-Kinney. I became friendly with them. We just had a lot of mutual friends. They came to New York to play. I just invited them to come to the show. They had a show that night, so they came to the after party, and I met Carrie there. And it was the strangest thing. Carrie and I just became instant friends.
Mm-hmm. That happens. And she knew who you were from the TV show?
Yeah, right. Fully. It just worked out.
You clicked.
Yeah, ever since then. And we just made these videos. You know, I'd go to Portland. It was like the equivalent of jamming, you know?
Yeah.
And so instead of doing that, which is just like, so what? You know, like, hey, we have this band. We just thought, let's make these videos. There was no pressure on it. It was just like, let's just
you
make them.
You just erase it if you didn't like it.
Yeah. For no reason. Let's just come up with characters. Let's make these tapes. And then we did. And then we had just all these videos on this website.
Now, if I remember reading that you did about a dozen of them, correct?
Yeah, that's about right. And then we just had enough to pitch a TV show.
And then how does Portlandia become a show? Who buys the show?
It was a kind of a thing where I was just talking to my manager. What do you want to do next? What's something you want to work on? And I thought, let's just turn it, see if we can turn it into something. And then Carrie and I just thought, yeah, let's pitch it.
Ready for that? Does she want that?
Yeah.
She seems like somebody who lived in Portland and lived on the fringe and was very, very talented deliberately.
Yes.
That she didn't want to be mainstream successful.
I think she just likes doing it.
Right.
So
she does what she wants.
She's a perfect mix of, like, she just enjoys, you know, performing and isn't, like, so crazy ambitious that she's like, okay, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? She's very, like, let's work on some projects. And a lot of it's our friendship. We just like working together. And then we pitched it to Broadway Video to, you know, Lauren, and as a group, we pitched it to IFC. They said, go ahead and do a pilot, which we did, and then next thing we knew, we were doing the show.
And you shoot the show in Portland, obviously.
Yeah.
Now, when you go there, I'm assuming, to start the show, you'd never lived there before.
No, but I'd gone there so much.
You had, because you'd spent so much time. So you knew what this Portland head was that to comment on.
I mean, that's what also got us to doing the show there. I mean, like, I would visit Carrie all the time. I'd shoot Thunder Ant. For years, I've been going there.
And she'd lived there for how long? Forever.
For a while. I think she's originally from Washington State, and then she moved to Portland, whatever, you know, 10 years ago or something.
So what is your experience being in Portland? Do people say stuff to you all the time at the show? They just love it.
They're so nice about it. And I really like it there. You know, I'm a city guy. I'm from New York, and I still love it there. It's smaller, but it's still a city and clean and nice and it's good food everywhere.
Civil.
Really civil, really just physically pretty and kind of overcast, which I really like.
Do you develop films now? Do you write films at all for yourself?
I've started to.
Yeah, you're good. Good
I've
idea.
Started to, yeah. Yeah. I feel like when I try to write something for myself, it ends up in TV form, but still I want to try to expand that.
You would never do a TV series?
I would do anything. Anything that seems interesting, I would do. Anything that seems like something, you know, good to be part of.
So when you sign a contract, like with Broadway Video, for those people who don't know this, that's Lauren's company, his production arm, and you have to deliver how many episodes?
10.
You just do 10.
First one was 6, second was 10, this one's going to be 10 also.
So this one's going to be 10.
10's a lot.
What do you do for fun?
I just work all the time.
All you do is work.
Yeah.
Because this is what you wanted.
Yeah.
This past season was Fred Armisen's 11th and final year on SNL, where he's performed alongside the biggest stars in the business. But Fred can still get starstruck, like when he met Steve Martin.
It's even weird talking about it because I feel like I know him somewhat.
Yeah, sure.
But the experience is greater than I ever thought it would be.
Right.
And then on top of it, the way he is. You know, that's part of the thing, seeing how people are as people. That's another nice surprise.
Coming up, we'll meet Paula Pell, a longtime writer on SNL, who Fred Armisen has called a true genius, one of the funniest people he's ever met. I'm Alec Baldwin, and here's the thing. Take a listen to our archive. More in-depth conversations with artists, policymakers, and performers, people like Lena Dunham, who agrees with Armisen.
Paula Pell is funny. Paula Pell is someone who is funny and not mean.
Yeah.
Paula Pell's
She's
like,
mean to the right people.
She's just a dreamy person.
Take a listen to my conversations with Dunham, Lorne Michaels, and Kristen Wiig.
I don't remember what I said.
At heresthething.org. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio and distributed by PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Departing SNL cast members are generally expected to springboard into a career in film. Maybe it's the punk rocker in him, but Fred Armisen doesn't seem entirely at home with that tradition.
Someday, want to invent a type of entertainment that is really blurry between comedy and something else that doesn't have a name yet, but I do want to see if there's another way to another level of fooling people as opposed to just doing a character, something a little bigger than that. And I don't know quite how to do it yet, but
do you think being famous has killed that opportunity for you personally?
Sometimes.
So that someone, you'd have to get someone else to do it.
Maybe.
You'd have to
yeah.
write and produce that.
Yeah.
And because you couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Because the minute you show up, they know something's going on.
But, yeah.
Do you find that? Do you find that when you walk up to people automatically, like someone said something to me, they said to me, you're at a wonderful place, which is also a terrible place.
Yeah.
That place where people are going to laugh at you whether you're funny or not. And
right.
he meant it as a dig.
Yeah.
Do you find that's true with you, that wherever you go, people are predisposed to you saying something?
Yeah. Or if I do like a stand-up show somewhere, I find that I want to put more effort into it, but sometimes I don't really have to.
Right.
So that might not be a good thing.
Right.
So,
what about in your personal life? How has your personal life changed as a result of being famous?
It's everything I ever wanted, but there are some things about it that are just very new and just very interesting. You know, like I love New York. I love riding on the subway. My subway rides aren't as private as they used to be.
Right.
That's when I start trying to think of ideas. I listen to music, and that's just different now.
And people say things to you.
Yeah. Perfectly nice. Perfectly nice. I would have done the same had I met whoever. But that's changed. It's like a different kind of subway ride.
What about your relationship with your family, your friends? I mean, do you still have the same friends?
Yeah, kind of. But I've gotten new friends, obviously.
New circles of friends come with each ladder you go up.
Yes. But I've maintained my friendships with the guys in the old band and people.
Odenkirk?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's in L.A. though, right?
Yeah. We just text each other and – yeah. So I do maintain relationships with these. Even if I'm if we're both busy, Paul F. Tompkins, whoever, I still try to keep those alive.
This is the last thing I want to say to you, which
you could say a million things to me.
Well, but I'm saying that without getting too personal, you know, you've been married twice.
Yeah.
And do you find – you were married twice, correct?
That's correct. And the first one was in Chicago before I was doing comedy.
Right.
And that's someone who I'm still friends with,
right.
Sally.
That was during the music days.
Yes, yeah.
The Keith Moon days.
Yeah.
And then you were married the second time.
Yes.
But would you say that, like, from things I've read, you find that because of what you crave and what you love, you speak very lovingly about Carrie and how you and she are just friends.
Yeah.
But she's like your, you know – she's your like last text of the day.
Yeah.
Do you think that she's kind of your soulmate?
Without a doubt. It's all the things that I've ever wanted, you know, aside from like the physical stuff.
Right.
But the intimacy that I have with her is like no other. Like it's something that, and it's only, it took me a while to realize, like, wait a minute, I am super, super close with her. I mean, we work all day together on Portlandia and then we hang out afterwards.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that?
Because people don't understand in this business how important that is. Like to have to be, it depends on who the person is.
Yeah. I also feel like you want someone who you can be not great around, meaning, you know, like right. like I want to be able to be kind of boring sometimes or say something dumb and it's okay.
Yeah.
That pressure is, I like that pressure not to be there, to have to be super funny and intelligent all the time. It's nice when I like.
Not just, that competitive.
Yeah, where I'm just like.
But the comedy world is very competitive, isn't it?
I guess. I haven't walked into that too much.
Right.
I wasn't part of a comedy troupe or anything. And so, and the stand-ups I've become friends with have all been very, you know, supportive. Definitely.
Portlandia Season 3 is now available on DVD. It enters its fourth season on IFC early next year. Fred, call me. Can I play a customer in Portlandia? Can I come to a restaurant?
Anytime.
Can I come and just do something? Can I order a... Who would I play and what would I order?
I think you would come from Southern California... And you'd order all kinds of meats. A meat aficionado. People think of it as a veggie place, but it's actually a very meaty place. They're very into, yeah, it's very like cured meats and sausages. But we haven't explored that much.
Maybe I could be a meat salesman.
Yeah, even better.
Maybe I could be a meat salesman with all kinds of charts and graphs of the loins and
anytime.
Pictures of the sections of the pig and the cow and the organs and the pig salesman.
Yeah, I love it. And the answer is yes.
Right.
Anytime.
I'll come see you in Portland.
Yeah.
If Fred invites me, I'll do it. And most likely, I'll do SNL the next time Lorne Michaels calls. And that's due in large part to the brilliant writing of my next guest. Not long ago, there used to be two types of comedians. Comedians and female comedians. Today, there are so many women making us laugh that the qualifier has been rendered obsolete. Saturday Night Live deserves a lot of the credit for this development. The show has introduced us to Gilda Radner, Jan Hooks, Maya Rudolph, Tina Fey, and Kristen Wiig, to name just a few. But there's been another woman at SNL, a woman who's been quietly working for nearly two decades, often without sleeping, to usher in this reality.
17 years I've been there, yep.
Paula Pell was working at a Florida theme park when she got her dream job as a writer at Saturday Night Live. Over the years, her sketches have ranged from Bobby and Marty and Debbie Downer to a personal favorite of mine, The Tony Bennett Show.
I love things that are great when things are fantastic. Guess what? We got a date, just a talk show, nothing drastic, but one thing's for sure.
Tina Fey wrote in her memoir that one of her prouder moments as head writer at SNL was fighting for one of Pell's sketches.
Introducing Kotex Classic.
Classic Kotex is a commercial for the feminine protection of yesteryear, featuring sexy women proudly encumbered with bulky pads connected to belts peeking out over their clothes.
I always know it's there. You can't beat the original.
Them girls are old school.
Paula Pell, in person, is genuine, charming, and easygoing. The kind of person you might actually talk to if you sat next to her on a plane, which is not a description of your typical comedy writer.
I was always a bit of a class clown. I was a good Catholic girl, so I always wanted to be, I never wanted to get in trouble, but I really pushed the envelope because I would be funny in class, and I'd do things like one of my teachers, I would do a bit where I would go by him and drag my hand along the chalk line, you know, the chalk shelf.
Right.
And then I'd come over and I'd say, you know, Mr. Gersh, you're just a really great teacher. And I'd pat him on the back and I'd leave like a handprint. He'd let me make him a little bit the fool for a moment, yeah. and then he'd do, you know, he looked like Rob Reiner in All in the Family. He had the big bushy mustache and the long hair.
He played along.
He just kind of looked to camera three, you know, non-existent. And the audience would, you know, the class would crack up. Or I'd pass notes and say, when I sneeze, because I have a really good fake sneeze, and I would say, when I sneeze, everybody fall off their chairs. And, you know, I'd always be doing something. But I grew up with an extremely funny dad, and my mom is
What did
super
he do for
funny.
A living?
He worked for Illinois Bell. We grew up in Illinois and then moved to Orlando when I was a teenager. But my entire childhood, my grandpa was a watchmaker for Westclex. So my dad always learned that from my grandpa. And then when he came to Florida, he worked for AT&T for many years. And then when he retired, he became a teacher of watch repair, watchmaking, all of it.
So how does the guy who works for the phone company and how does he – and he becomes – a watch tinkerer. How was the funny in his life?
Well,
was at home.
He's just ungodly witty. He's really.
But never wanted to be in the business himself, or did he express to you that he did?
I mean, he probably did, but you know, I look at all the people in my family and all the relatives of different generations, and they all had their thing. You know, my mom has a beautiful singing voice. They all had something that they wanted to do, but the way they grew up was you just. You know, you have kids early and you kind of figure out what you need to do to pay for that. And so they, you know, a lot of times didn't have the luxury that kids have now, even though it's hard to get a job, to say, you know, oh, I'm doing this.
And
I'm getting a degree in this.
What was wrong with you, Paula, that you didn't sign on to that program? What was wrong with you?
Well,
you wouldn't just do what you were supposed to do.
They knew that I was pretty hopeless. I mean, at my confirmation, where you get the Holy Spirit, yeah. I came down the stairs at my party and had torn like 80 holes in my pantyhose and said I had the Holy Spirit. And just would do things like that all the time, you know. And this was before I drank or smoked anything.
Yeah.
But, no, I was always a total ham. But my dad really taught me that. He will just do a bit that will just have us crank. And I will tell you that one of the hardest times I laughed at him is my mom and I were watching Die Hard on television. My dad's cutting the yard, and he's outside cutting the yard. He's got his little jean shorts on and his tank top, and he keeps coming in and walking by and kind of half listening. He's a really good, quiet half listener, but then he'll do something based on what he's been listening to. I, you know, was listening to my mom, and the terrorist had the long blonde hair, you know, the big, like, kind of Nordic guy at the beginning.
Yeah, the ballet dancer.
Yeah, and my mom says, you know, I don't know, but I don't like long hair, but that is pretty foxy. And she's, like, commenting on him. So we're laughing about it and everything. And then, I'm not kidding, like, an hour later, my dad just walked through. He had gone in my room and gotten a wig, put a long wig on with just his grass cutting stuff and just walked through. He didn't stop. He didn't do a bit. He just walked through.
But they also knew that rule, like that you keep the ball in the air and play along. They were good.
Yes.
Without the training, they were good improv people.
Oh, yeah.
The answer's always yes.
He's the king of like a prop. And what I love about it is my parents are in their 70s now. And, you know, and my mom was always like, you'd say, you know, you go, oh, God, Dad is so funny. And she goes, thank God. Thank God he's funny. We had so much laughter in our house, you know, despite any dysfunction as any family, we always laugh.
Where did you go to college?
I went to college at University of Tennessee. I first went to a local college in Orlando, a community college for 2 years.
So you moved to Florida?
I moved to Florida. My dad went down for AT&T for that antitrust suit that they had.
Mm-hmm. When they broke up the phone system.
Yeah, it was like late 70s.
70s.
You know, we had gone a few times down to Disney World with our little pop-up camper, and, like, that was a vacation place. That wasn't a place you move.
Sure.
And my parents sent us brought back a little Polaroid of the house they bought, and it was, you know, about $70,000, but it had this gigantic pool, because in Orlando, so many people have pools,
sure.
even with, you know, inexpensive houses. And we just thought we won the lottery, you know, it was just insane. But we got there, and it was really hard the first year. I just never liked to be... I mean, I think being new is a very important thing to do for growth. I think it really galvanizes a lot of stuff inside you of who you are and everything. And I'm glad in hindsight. But I used to just wake up in the morning and just cry. And, you know, just because I had so much familiarity and comfort with all the kids that I went to school with, it's just I was always quiet at first, you know. And then by my senior year, I got really involved in school. And the girls, you know, would go... Because I remember when you'd come in, you know, you came in your junior year, and I'd say, oh, really? Really? Because I came in my sophomore year and sat next to you for an entire class, and you were, you know, a cold little ass wipe to me. But, you know, that's all right now. We're friends.
And what was the difference for you in terms of the people, if you can characterize? Well, I mean, from Illinois to Florida, I mean, Florida,
well,
I'm sure,
biggest,
was a lot different.
I mean, one thing that really helped me was I always sang. So I went in immediately into a concert choir. And so that was wonderful because then I had a social group pretty quickly. But the one thing about Florida that was so different that freaked me out was that, you know, I never thought I was growing up in Illinois in necessarily a cold sort of atmosphere. It was emotionally warm. I had great friends. My family warm. But when I got to Florida, everybody hugged constantly.
Really? I would have thought it was the other way
around. Everyone
was
so affectionate in such a crazy way that I remember saying,
Take your hands off me.
I remember coming home and going, stop cupping my nipples, tenor. I don't know you in the choir. No, but people would... I kept thinking it was our director's birthday or something. I was like, what the hell is going on in here? Everyone is hugging our teacher, hugging each other. I realized that was just the way everyone did, you know. And then who eventually became my girlfriend of many years, was my best friend in high school. And we were very huggy, and that all worked out.
Yeah. It was like, as long as it's the right person, not the teacher.
Not until after we graduated,
exactly,
though.
Then you went to the college down there?
I went to the college for 2 years down there.
And studied what?
Well, their theater department was amazing. Their art department was incredible, and I was also an artist.
What was it called? Seminole State?
Seminole Community College. But, I mean, the heads of those departments and the music department were so incredible that today they still are some of my, you know, favorite people that
then
I've
why'd
ever
you go to Tennessee?
Gotten taught. Because my art professor, Grady Kimsey, who I'm a really good friend with still, he had gone to UT years and years ago, and he just kept saying, you got to go check out UT. And then my girlfriend was going to North Carolina, so it kind of, you know, I'd go up and visit, and I'd never been up in those mountains, and I just fell in love with it.
Did
up
you?
There, because I'm such a nature freak, and yeah, I went crazy for it.
And when you left there, what happened?
And then I finished college, and I came home, and I worked at the theme parks.
What's that like? How do you get the job at Disney? Like, is there somebody who's like a casting person,
well,
a talent director?
Yeah, there's talent people. And, you know, I had worked with an improv group called SAC Theater in Orlando. They, at the time, contracted out to Disney. So they did all the, like, in Epcot in Italy, the Commedia dell'arte. You know, they would do all the comedy that's kind of the roaming atmospheric comedy. And then they built Pleasure Island, which was the nighttime Disney, you know, all the nightclubs.
Pleasure Island.
Pleasure Island.
Welcome.
Come. Mickey has no pants on.
It was New Year's Eve every night.
Mickey slipped you a roofie. Pleasure Island.
An entire island they built that had all these clubs. They had like a big discotheque. They had a country western sort of music club. It was just kind of like a strip of nighttime establishments, but all in Disney. But it was late night. And
kind of a downtown feel, like a cluster, like South Street, Seaport.
And they would have like New Year's Eve every night. So they'd have dancers come out and they'd dance. And it was really a fabulous place to work as a young actor because it felt cool, and I did a lot of improvisation, but then we also did like radio shows and singing. We could be kind of dirty. I mean, it wasn't filthy. I didn't go full tilt, my typical filth that you know of.
Yeah, you didn't pell out.
I didn't pell out. But you would interact with the guests. So there, you know, you'd be sitting there with some old British dude who's getting drunk and just get into a conversation. And I played Pamelia Perkins, the president of the Adventurers Club. And it was kind of a Teddy Roosevelt era sort of place. And I had this big bouffant. And I could just be as bawdy as hell. I mean, I would get on guys' laps and, you know, have my legs up in the air because I was like a matron sort of character. And we used to have such a blast. Also, during that time, I went down Penis Avenue for about 2 years. I was dating men for a little while, and I would hook up with people. I mean, just meeting, like, different people. I'd meet, just guests. And, you know, you'd meet some super, super charismatic, handsome person, and you'd be sitting there laughing, and you'd be in costume, and then they'd be like, what are you guys doing after?
Yeah, what do these characters do next?
And there was a restaurant, and there were bars down the street that they would let us, after work, go to. So you'd just change all your clothes and, you know, blow dry your hair and go, now I'm 25 again. And I'd walk down there and
it was New Year's Eve every day.
It was New Year's Eve.
So
you vomited every day and lost your virginity every day.
Yes. What was the character's name?
Pamelia Perkins.
Pamelia Perkins. Of course she's banging the guests two at a time.
For an actor at that time, I was making really good money and had full insurance, everything, had a car, rented a little house. You know, it was
having
kind of
plenty
like
of fun.
It was a beautiful
blow
life.
Blow drying your hair.
It was a beautiful life. And then I got stir crazy with it. And that was just about when the SNL thing happened.
But how does that happen? How do they find you?
It was a beautifully random, amazing thing. I had worked with SAC Theater. They had a theater downtown. They would call me every so often, and I'd go do a set with them where I'd do a character that I had written. And so they said, you know, we're going to do this sketch comedy pilot called Chucklehead. And they said, will you be in it and do those characters? And I said, sure. I mean, I was doing like I Got Beat Up in America's Most Wanted, you know, all the things that were shooting in Orlando I would do, you know. And I did this lottery character for years in about three states that was played the Wurlitzer organ. You know, sexy characters, Alec, you know. But all from the Matron Handbook. I was born at 50, Alec.
Yes.
But they called me. My agent called me one day and she said, are you sitting down? I said, yes. She said, Saturday Night Live saw that pilot and Lauren wants to meet you. And I'm like, okay, for what? And she goes, now, it is not an audition, but he wants to fly you up and talk to you. And I'm like, well, what is it? An orgy?
Right.
Am I being summoned?
Mickey Mouse. It's Pleasure Island.
What in the F? And I said, okay. And so I flew up there. He was 2 hours, you know, or 3 hours late for the meeting. But he was super nice. And I sat with Marcy Klein and Ayala in the talent room. And I was so nervous that they ordered food. And they said, we're ordering Zen Palette, you know, vegetarian. We're ordering Zen Palette. Do you want anything? And I said, just like a cup of white rice would be good. Just like rice. And I just got a dry cup of white rice and sat and ate it. I went in and he said, we have just cleaned house. It was 95. It was when Will Ferrell and everybody came. He said, we've cleaned house. We're starting over. You know, it's going to rise again. We're hoping and we're going to try to infuse it with new talent. And we would like to hire you to be a writer. And I was like, oh, well, I've never done that. I didn't even use a computer at that point. And I said, I can't, you know. And if you tell them you can't, then they will, keep saying, well. And he said, well, we'll show you, you know.
No, we have people for that.
But it was so quick that it made me worry that there was something wrong. Like there was a scam or something. Like this was all some kind of freaking joke because I was like, this can't be. And
how soon after that were you moving to New York?
I had 5 days to move. Packed up my whole life, gave my animals to my mom temporarily.
Said farewell to Pleasure Island.
Went up to New York City and, you know, just was just ungodly miserable. And, I mean, with fear. But Mike Shoemaker called me right before I left because I was starting to freak out to the point of going, I'm going to my dream place. I mean, I was obsessed with SNL when I was little. I used to audio tape it. I used to perform Rosanna Dana for my high school in the auditorium. And I thought, I'm just going to be sitting around with like, you know, 10 Harvard dudes looking at me going, who hired Kathy Bates Light? And, you know, and why is she here? And I adore Kathy Bates, by the way.
Yeah.
But they were just, you know, I thought I would be so not of their world of these writerly sort of people. And I didn't realize how many writers there are performers. And so Shoemaker called me, and I still thank him for this because he really is the reason that I ended up getting the balls to get there. But he called, and he said, some people want to say hi. And it was, you know, Cindy Caponera and Lori Nasso and all these people that were new that were terrified. And they all got on the phone going, we can't wait to meet you. And I hung up the phone, and I just burst into tears. I said, it's all going to be okay, no matter what. It's going to be okay.
And it was.
It's just a group of people. It's almost like of all the years of doing plays, it's like it's a new cast.
And that's
you're
17
you're
years
getting
ago.
In a cast. 17 years I've been there, yep. 17.
And how's it changed?
Well, one of the biggest things that's changed in general to me is the internet, because when I was growing up and you were an actor, you had to create a body of work by really doing it and getting hired, and then they would give you access to tape of it. You know, you couldn't just go on machines and videotape yourself and make a beautifully edited, great comedy piece and put that on the internet.
I mean, float it out there.
You just can't do it.
The internet has changed things profoundly.
Yeah, and I think in a bad way, it gave people a sense of entitlement of there isn't as much awe of all of it because they do it themselves. So it's like, oh, yeah, I have you know, this, and I've done my show. You know, they create it themselves, which is very empowering and wonderful. And it's also getting a lot more comedy out there of hilarious people that would never usually walk into a room nervous in an audition. Right, right.
But that's rare.
Right.
So that seems to me to have been the condition for me, which is I'd come to SNL and the signals that I picked up in 1990, Jan Hooks and all that crowd back then, was, you know, my career wasn't that iconic to send up me and my career. And so it's not like I'm Stallone or Schwarzenegger or something like that where we do that. So you come in and right away you pick up, I've got to become like everybody else and become a member of the company.
Right, right.
And as soon as I got that, as soon as I kind of picked up that vibe from them, I was, you know, asked to come back and come back and come back. And what it does is, for me as a performer, it's killed everything else that's supposed to be funny. And I wonder what that's like for you, where you're in the world where you work with the funniest people. No matter what people say about SNL, you know, it's not always going to work. But when it works, it's, I still think it's the best. What's it been like for you?
Well, you get so isolated there in great ways and weird ways, because there's nothing like it. You cannot compare that experience with anything. But it really is so intense. And you know, I started writing movies 2 years ago, and working into that, I realized how stretched out the time is, to the point where, you know, I mean, we'll go between dress and air, and Lauren will say, I don't like the whole top of that. Like, add, you know, a couple new jokes. So you're coming up with new jokes at 11:15. And
but let me just put a finer point on that for our radio audience, because that SNL does a full dress rehearsal at 8 o'clock on Saturday night with an audience with a lengthier show. And they're going to pick what worked best, and then they're going to rewrite. So when that finishes at 10, maybe 10:15, maybe 10:30, who knows?
If it's a long show.
If it's a long show. And then you've got an hour where you're sitting in a room, and in that hour between shows, that's when Lorne and the producers and the writers edit that show and choose what they're going to do and ask for rewrites.
And they're getting rid of that audience. They're bringing in a new one. The band is warming up the new audience. And you'll walk through and have a task to change something, and you're walking by these people that are walking in to their seats looking like, I'm so excited I'm here. And you're like, I don't know what we're going to have for you, but we're going to do it right now. You know, I'm pretty sure that if, like, Dr. Oz did my actual age, you know how they test you on your actual, I'm probably 180 now because of the stress of that. It's just such adrenaline. And, you know, but I mean, the beautiful thing about SNL is hosts will come in and, you know, never you, because you were always very approachable. But, like, you know, hosts will come in with their people, and they're very nice and very scared.
But stand over there,
but they have a little bit of that sometimes, because they're fearful and they have people protecting them. And by the end of the week, they're just always at that after party. You know, they're sitting with everybody and laying across everybody, because it feels like theater. It feels like
camp.
I'm in theater camp, and this is what I miss doing.
In a minute, Paula Pell shares her plans for retirement.
I want to go live the lesbian life.
I want to be on a lesbian farm.
I want to wear my dance go clogs.
Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio and distributed by PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. My guest, Paula Pell, has been writing sketches at Saturday Night Live for almost two decades. She no longer works full-time on the show. Lately, she's branched into both TV and film comedies as well. Even still, Pell admits that on some days, she wants to curl up on the couch and watch something, well, not funny.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Well, you just want to watch the sorrow and the pity.
No, my gal of 14 years, she watches a lot of TV, and she watches shows that I wouldn't generally watch like Castle or, you know, like Hawaii Five-O or like Murder, She Wrote. And she, I mean, you know, murder shows, CSI, NCIS. Sure. She'll watch all. She'll tape all these shows in like Elementary, all these new shows. And I'll get totally hooked on things and realize that I always loved having drama and comedy together. I mean, that's the fun thing about writing movies now is you can have a moment that's just a heart-wrenching moment in a comedy that's real, you know, that feels more three-dimensional. Because after 17 years of sketches, you do get a little stir-crazy with feeling like you're just writing something on the surface. I mean, it's great to make people laugh, but when I go home, I love to watch dramas or some reality things. I love to just not think about comedy too much.
Yeah, I mean, I do the show and I go out there and it's really, and I'll say, I'm never doing this again. Yeah. This is ridiculous. Yeah. I can't be bothered with this hosting this ridiculous show.
These people are too young.
These people are all young and they're all crazy and they're all puerile and all they talk about is farts and brassieres and so forth. I'm going to go do As You Like It in the Park. Then, of course, you know, Lauren calls me. I'm like, nah, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Or he'll call me like I get thrown off the plane on American Airlines for playing Words with Friends. The phone rings like 3-4 days later. It's Lauren. And he literally goes, so perhaps we should do something. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe you people are insane.
This
like,
would be
yeah,
the week.
Yeah. He said, that's it.
This would be the week.
This would be the week, you know, it's like that thing where we have to do it now. Now, you left to do a television show.
I left about 6 years ago to do, I wrote a pilot called Thick and Thin that was about two fat sisters that grew up fat and one gets really hot and thin and beautiful.
Who was it for?
NBC.
For NBC.
Yeah. We shot the pilot. It got picked up for like 13, but it was a bad year for multi-camera sitcoms. It was kind of when they were getting phased out. And it was also about a subject that was a little weird still back in that era of, you know, there wasn't a whole bunch of stuff with weight stuff. And I really wanted, like, real people that look fat, you know, that look fat because I had struggled with my weight all my life and lost huge amounts of weight a couple times in my life. The process of developing a network show like that is so hard. And sure. I really, in hindsight, learned so many things after the fact. You know,
One thing you learned that you can say? What'd you learn?
Well, the biggest thing I learned was I'm a people pleaser and I always like to get to know people and see the good sides of them. And I wanted to have a lot of positive energy with them because I had known so many people that developed stuff that were like, welcome to hell. But I befriended everyone so intensely, you know, especially like network people and everything. I befriended everyone. So then there was this sort of discomfort at telling them things they didn't want to hear or me pushing back in bigger ways.
Right.
And so, because I had already established that we're all just friends and we're all having fun and we're laughing, then they would suggest things that were just show ruining. And I would just be like, okay, well, you know, and I just at the time didn't really have my voice as a creative person to lead something like that, you know.
Right.
So I regret that, and I regret not pushing more. I mean, casting was, you know, a little brutal just because of the weight thing. Is they would bring people in that were – I wanted real people that were – you know, I wanted the other sister to be a real heavy person. And when they'd audition heavy people, sometimes I'd watch their faces when they're auditioning them, and they're kind of like looking at their bodies, and I'm going, this is not good. They don't get it that, like, you know, Roseanne was friggin' huge hit show. It's like, come on. I don't even remember who said this to me, but one of the network people pulled me aside during one of the castings and she said, did you audition this other girl for that part for the heavy sister? And I said, no, I auditioned her for the thin sister. And she said, you couldn't pad her, could you? And I just remember walking away going, this is so dead in the water, you know?
Now, movies. You're doing a movie now.
Yeah, I did. I worked a little bit on Bridesmaids. I just came a couple different times and just, you know, pitched jokes on the set, did that kind of thing. Had never done anything movie-wise ever. And I really, really had fun doing it. I really enjoyed it. And then Judd started hiring me to do some rewrites on different movies and punch-ups and stuff. And then last summer, I worked on my first full movie experience with This Is 40. I was the executive producer on that. I've finally kind of gotten my foothold in the movie thing now, and it's
like it.
Really fun. I really love it. It's a lot of waiting around for news on things. It's a lot of, you know, I can't plan anything because you don't know what your next year is going to be.
It's stressful in a different way.
You find out, but so beautiful to be able to work at home with my animals and Dee, and just like to be. You
are a home buddy, aren't you?
Well,
you always come back to the same thing when I've spoken to you. When you left, I was despondent when you left because, you know, you were such a great. You're such a great writer. You're one of my favorite writers of all time. You're so
sweet.
Funny. No,
I
but I really mean that. And you, and then when you left and you said the same thing, you're like, oh, I just want to go home to Dee and my animals.
My animals.
And my animals.
I want to go live the lesbian life.
I want to be on a lesbian farm.
I want to wear my Dansko clogs. I want to get a mag light and go under a dumpster and get some feral cats out of there. I have a horse up there. I have, you know, just it's so beautiful and inexpensive up there in the Hudson Valley. It's like the amazing place. But also just I'm realizing, too, just the finite amount of time. You know, I've spent more time since I've been doing the movie stuff the last 2 years. I've spent more time with my family. I've been down in Florida a lot to visit them. It's just feeling so much better for me. And also I love, like, Lauren, whenever I'm there, I did the Louis C.K. show, and I'm doing this next two here. And, you know, Lauren will say to me, it's still fun, right? It's fun. You had fun. And I go, oh, my God, it's amazing.
It is fun.
But if I did it all the time now, I would be like a bitter hag, because I just feel like I wasn't having time or energy to do other things. And also everyone is very young. I mean, my nieces and nephews I saw delivered out of my sister's vagine, and they are in their mid-20s, and one's a physician's assistant, and one's a... I mean, I've named myself at SNL Nanny SNL, because I'll sit at the rewrite table like, what is the name of that?
Yeah.
Who's that detective on television? I'm like...
I call myself Grandpa.
Oh, my God.
I go,
you know?
Grandpa, they'll knock on the door and say, we're ready. I'm like, Grandpa will be right there. It'll be right there, God damn it.
But if you have a good night there, you feel like you're 20 again. I mean, you know, you feel like, I mean, last week I had a really fun sketch I wrote with Kate McKinnon. I just went home on that old school SNL high, just a whole high, you know, like the whole weekend just bouncing off the walls. And then you start going, maybe I could do this all the time. I got it's like, no, I'm going to do it.
I would leave there after a good show. I'd leave there and say, I'm going to be a cast addition. Now, Twitter. You kill me on Twitter.
Thank you.
You talk about, like, I was laying on a bed and I was having a great time and I was eating snacks and I was really cozy and everything was just, I felt so great. And then security guard came up and said to me, you know, Target is closed, man. You know, it's like the Tony Bennett routine.
People always really respond to my Target tweets.
Twitter is just another forum for you.
Twitter is really, I got very addicted to it just because it's so simple and it's like a video game for comedy writers to just do a one-liner about something. And I started doing these Hey Young Girl tweets.
I know, I love
them. And I might do a little book of them maybe and illustrate it. You know, my nieces, I just used to drive them insane when they were growing up because I was so protective.
Give me an example. You said that, what was it? Hey Girls, I remember.
Hey, young girls, keep your boobs in your shirt, your butt in your pants, your eyes on your dreams, your head in the cloud, you know,
but
like that kind of thing.
But you also say the thing about, you know, if the guy does this.
Yeah.
Wait, I remember reading
The Hey Young Girl stuff just came out of my nieces because I would bring them to SNL and they were just these drop dead gorgeous girls, and they would have people. I'm not talking about people just checking them out, but like at the if I brought them backstage or whatever, there'd be some dude that would just end up coming up and saying, you know, really aggressive checking them out. And so they still imitate me, how I would grab them with my meaty Polish farm wife arm and go, she's 14. You want to talk about it? I mean, I would just become this raving, crazy woman looking at them like, get, you know. And so I'd always be like, are you sexually active? I would always want to know all their details and everything.
Like a character out of a Rock Hudson movie.
Yeah.
You're the chaperone.
I'm the chaperone scurrying my son away from the hoochie dancers.
It's ironic that Paul Appel has thrived in the notoriously cutthroat culture of SNL. You get a sense that she is, by nature, a maternal figure, often encouraging up-and-coming comedy writers.
Like I've always said about SNL, it's like the funny rises to the top with it. And if somebody's super funny and has abandon and joy and they're not trying, you know, I don't like ever with a comedy person, them acting like someone else or acting dirty just to be funny. I'm the filthiest person on earth, but if it's not funny, dirty,
I can vouch for that.
If I'm not being funny,
clever
dirty, you know, then forget it, because there's got to be some class to my vulva joke.
Your culo.
If a vulva joke does not have a class to it, then forget it. But, you know, for a while there, some auditions I would watch where girls would come out and just try to just sex it up and be funny and dirty, you know, and it's like, that's
well,
not
with
funny.
Women, you feel like not all of them, certainly, but enough of them. They go out in front of a camera, a lot of them in the comedy world, and they think, feel like, well, I don't want to go too far over this line because I don't want to lose this other thing.
Right.
I really would like to kiss Leo in a movie.
Right.
I want to be, as
you
much as I think
you
that
you don't want to see anyone thinking too hard while they're, you know, the greatest auditions at SNL were people that came in purely as themselves, came in, did a bunch of crazy ass characters, and you just went, this is a force of nature. What is this? What is this human? Like, they are making me laugh so hard, and I don't even know what where they're getting it from.
Women have that the condition, though, where it's like they sit there and they, you know, I mean, I've seen women who they would make fun of actresses. I mean, I'm talking mm-hmm. about comedy women.
Yeah.
They would just tear apart. They would lacerate actresses who they thought were, you know, leaning too much on the sex button. Mm-hmm. And then those comedy actresses became stars, and they popped another button, and they put the makeup on their cleavage, and they were
right.
like, and they were just like, they were camera ready. I mean, they became the thing they made fun of.
Yeah.
And you realize for women, that's a tough angle. You know what I mean?
Comedy girls tended to grow up being the goofy looking, you know, the goofy looking ones that weren't getting the attention that
yeah.
way. So when they become famous and have a lot of money and people putting beautiful dresses on them,
yeah,
I think they do go that way. You know, I mean, I've got a lot of pretty sparkly pantsuits I wear to the Emmys now, and I really get up my own ass on it.
Paula Pell is working on a few side projects, but as a fan, I hope that Paula doesn't give up her night job and has another 17 years of sketch writing ahead of her.
Thanks, sugar.
This is Alec Baldwin. You can hear more conversations in our archive, from Nobel Prize-winning economists to NFL quarterbacks.
They are the apex of physical freaks. You know, there are some guys that are 300 pounds that are running faster, you know, running
than your high school running back.
Yeah.
Listen to more at heresthething.org. Here's the Thing is produced by Emily Botine and Kathy Russo, with Chris Bannon, Jim Briggs, Wendy Dore, Ed Herbstman, Melanie Hoops, Monica Hopkins, Trey Kay, Sharon Mashihi, and Lou Okowski. Thanks to Larry Josephson and the Radio Foundation. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio and distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.